Hi, and welcome back to Undisclosed Toward Justice, our weekly episode. And Rob, you here. I'm joined with my colleague, Colin Miller. Hey, Colin.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going well. How are you doing?
Doing great. Classes are about to end, so I'm looking forward to some grading and then the summer.
Oh, yeah, man. I can't believe it. The spring's almost over, huh?
Yeah.
Well, it's a perfect time to pick up a new true crime podcast, by the way, if you haven't got your breaks coming up. And I'm really excited to have our guest on today, but I'm going to let you introduce our guest today, Colin.
Yeah, our guest today is Jen Miller. She is the creator and host of the true crime series Blood Will Tell. She is a journalist by trade. She has written 5 books, and her articles have appeared in outlets like the New York Times and the Washington Post. She has her Master's of Fine Art from Columbia, as well as a Master's in Journalism. And previously in her line of work, she was a Senior Media Fellows Program Fellow at the American Immigration Council, helping over 1,000 people to tell their own immigration stories. And very much Blood Will Tell is the story of an immigrant family. And so, Jen, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for that introduction. And thank you so much for having me. Really happy to be here.
Yeah. Can we start there with your work as a fellow and helping these immigrants to tell their stories to sort of set the stage for the podcast?
Yeah, that's fascinating.
Absolutely. And yeah, and this is work that I still do for the council, which, you know, is really some of the most fulfilling work that I've done over the course of my career. So for the last decade or so, my team has worked with immigrants both immigrants and also native-born Americans who have interactions with immigrants and then, you know, immigrants from every walk of life. And we help them to tell their stories in local and national media. Most of what we do is actually community specific. So we work with a lot of small town newspapers, and you'll have, you know, folks who have settled in, you know, fairly rural areas, even around the country. We help them to actually have a voice in their communities. So we talk with them about, you know, what are the issues that are important to them, both having to do with immigration, but also just what it's like to remake your life in a new country. And what are the challenges of that? What are the joys of that? And we work with them, you know, these are mostly people that don't have writing experience. And we work with them to craft personal essays and op-eds, and then we help them get them published.
That's amazing work. Can you tell me, like, are you working in certain parts of the country, or is this kind of all over the country?
It's nationwide. So
okay.
The 1,000 or so people that we've worked with, I believe that we have helped folks publish their pieces in almost every state. I don't think we've worked with anyone in Mississippi. I'm like trying to think. There are very few states that we haven't worked in.
Yeah.
You know, what's really cool, we've even supported the creation of new newspaper columns. So,
that's wonderful.
Yeah. So like one of the program's like best successes, I think, there's a former Afghan refugee in Northern Virginia. She's a community college professor there. And we helped her to launch a column in Prince William Today, also called Inside Nova. And she's telling stories of local immigrants in her community, of, you know, what it's like being a woman in her community and a leader in her community. And it's just been wonderful to be able to support someone to like help them build their platform and to really have that voice.
I've thought a lot about this because, you know, my parents immigrated from Pakistan in the 70s. I was an infant, so I always saw was an immigrant. But that particular generation of immigrants that, you know, I who came in that wave, like 70s and early 80s, that they kind of just kept their head down, worked hard, put down roots. These generations are better at telling their stories. But I think a lot about like the fact that I've lost my parents, that we've lost a lot of stories. We've lost a lot of stories. So this is incredible work. And I want to also, your books, can you tell us about the books you've written?
Well, so I've written a few works of nonfiction. The first book that I did back in 2005, I think, is called Inheriting the Holy Land. I follow Israeli and Palestinian teenagers through the Second Intifada. So I was traveling around Israel and the West Bank and Gaza and talking to kids really from all different backgrounds, experiences, just about what it was like to be them at this very difficult, explosive moment, to really try to understand the world through their eyes. And I think, you know, that's been a lot of the reporting that's like really impacted my reporting career moving forward. I mean, I don't cover the Middle East anymore. But the most recent book I had out is called Rising Class. It's about first generation and low income college students. Mm. So I followed a handful of kids over their first year. Actually, it turned out to be the pandemic year. So it was it was pretty intense and challenging. But these were kids who were the first in their families to go to college and what that experience was like. Again, it's that same theme of like trying to find home and belonging, which I think really runs through all of my work.
Yeah. And sticking with the pandemic year, and we were talking before we started recording, I think you said 2020 is when this story first came on your radar. And it was you were looking into the use of drama in Shakespeare as therapy for people who are incarcerated, right?
Yeah, I was writing a story for the Washington Post about that California had recently seen all of these criminal justice reforms in their prisons. They were offering people who were incarcerated a lot more autonomy over their time in prison and really giving them opportunities if they wanted to take them to really work on themselves and to really delve into their own psychology and to kind of explore in a really deep way, like, how were they raised? How did their, you know, that kind of nature versus nurture thing. And so I was at San Quentin Penitentiary reporting on this Shakespeare troupe comprised almost entirely of incarcerated men. And it was a rehearsal for Othello. They were rehearsing the final act of Othello, which is incredibly intense. And I wanted to talk to somebody there. I mean, it was very random. I asked the director, can I talk to someone who's been in this program for a while, who's getting out soon? Because I wanted to try to understand how a program like this might set them up for reintegration. And the director of the Shakespeare program introduced me to Trung, who becomes the main source in Blood Will Tell. He and I sat down while the rehearsal was happening. He was getting out in 3 weeks, coinciding almost with the start of lockdown. So it was, you know, we didn't know that then, obviously. But, and I asked him, I said, you know, why did you join the Shakespeare troupe? And I mean, I've been a reporter for 25 years. I have never had an experience like this before. He just spilled this story that, I mean, I have never heard a story like this or have someone just, I mean, I couldn't believe it. I would, the whole time I'm just thinking to myself, this can't be real. Like, there's no way this is real. It was real.
So many of our lives are so stressful. About 28% of lawyers experience depression, while 19% suffer from anxiety. And the same goes for many jobs and personal issues that we face. But one thing that shouldn't add to our stress is finding a therapist who actually takes your insurance. But Rula does things differently. They partner with over 100 insurance plans, making the average copay just $15 per session. That's real therapy from licensed professionals at a price that actually makes sense. Go to Rula.com/undisclosed to get started today. That's RULA.com/undisclosed for quality therapy that's covered by insurance. Rula isn't just affordable. The experience is tailored around you. Other online therapy platforms might match you with the first available provider, regardless of whether they're the right fit for you. Rula considers your goals, your preferences, and your background to provide you with a curated list of licensed in-network therapists who are actually aligned with what you need. There's no wait list and no frustrating back and forth. Rula makes it easy to find a mental health provider who's accepting new patients, and appointments are available as soon as tomorrow. Plus, Rula sticks with you throughout your journey, checking in to make sure your care is helping you move forward. Thousands of people are already using Rula to get affordable, high-quality therapy that's actually covered by insurance. Visit Rula.com/undisclosed to get started. That's RULA.com/undisclosed. You deserve mental health that works with you and not against your budget.
It It is a wild story, and it's an incredibly painful, tragic story. And so, well, that turned into this podcast now, right? Bud Will Tell. Is this your first podcast, or have you?
This is my first podcast. Yes.
Your debut. It won't be last. You think you do a podcast, you're going to be done. Then you'll just do them forever.
I hope so.
Especially with how well this one came. It was a great, you would never know it was your first podcast. It flowed together so
Thank
well.
Thank you
it was
so much.
So can you tell us the story that Trung tells you and who he is and tell us about him?
Sure. Okay, so I'll start with the crux of the story, which is that Trung and his identical twin brother go to a party one night when they're 18 years old. They get into a fight. Trung stabs a man. Both of the twins are arrested, and they are both put in a lineup. And Trung's identical twin brother, An, is the one who is pointed out in the lineup. And then An ends up taking the fall for Trung. And An sits in county jail for nearly 2 years before. So he doesn't say that his brother is guilty, and Trung doesn't come forward to, wow, you know, absolve his brother. And then, you know, I don't want to give away too. Right. I mean, already that's already that it could be 15 shows already. But you know, for me, what was so fascinating about this story was the twins' relationship. Like, this is really a story about two brothers, about kind of how the people who are closest to us really define us, shape who we are, and then the sacrifices that we are or are not willing to make for those people.
And that's informed a lot by the family's history and these two brothers growing up, right? Because going back to the immigrant story, what's the story of this family?
Yeah. So so Trung and An were born in South Vietnam. They're about 30 now. They lived in Vietnam until they were 8 years old. Their dad, Duc, had fought in the South Vietnamese army. He had been in a communist re-education camp for almost 3 years. And on their mom's side, their mom's family, only a few members of the family were able to flee the country after Saigon fell. And so you have two parents who are on the losing side of this war, the father who has actively fought against the communist regime. And because of, you know, I would say because of how kind of absurd our immigration system is, they weren't able to leave the country. Like, Duc, you know, there was a program to bring people here who had been in re-education camps. He missed the cut by like 2 or 3 months, you know, and you're going to say that what his trauma and his experience wasn't, you know, didn't meet the standard.
And this is about what, about 25 years ago or so? When they missed the cut and they were trying to come here, like when they were...
Oh, well, so that would have been much longer, because Saigon fell in 1975.
Okay.
And so this would have been in, like, you know, within the decade after that, into the mid-80s. And so the family, you know, they remake their lives in Vietnam. The twins are born in, I think, 1995, but their parents just had never given up on this dream of being able to come here. And there was still a lot of discrimination against people who fought for the South, even though, you know, they were able to remake their lives. And so the twins' mom, her green card comes through because her sister had been able to leave the country. But the dad's green card doesn't come through. And so the parents, Trung and An's parents, make this very difficult decision to send their mom to California and kind of try to put down roots. And then the twins and the dad will follow. And that means that these brothers are without their mom, you know, from age 4 or 5 until age 8. And I think, you know, that is really hard for them, and that's really hard on the parents' marriage. Finally, when the twins turn 9, Duc's green card comes through. They all move to San Jose. The family is reunited, and they are, you know, ostensibly getting on with their lives. And they, you know, San Jose has a very robust Vietnamese community, which, you know, has done really well, kind of writ large. But, you know, in every community, there are haves and have-nots. And it was really, really hard for the twins' family. They're living in public housing. Mm-hmm. Their parents are, you know, struggling to make ends meet. And they are living in an area that there's a lot of gang violence. There's organized crime. And there's really just a sense, I think, for the twins that they just don't know who they are. Like, they don't mm-hmm. know who they are in this country. And they're trying to figure it out. And that leads them to make some pretty bad choices.
And they're the only two siblings, right? There's no other siblings. It's just them two.
Living in the house. There are half siblings that, but yeah, no, it's just the two of them coming here. And so they are, they are attached. I mean, their parents from the time they were little are like dressing them the same, same haircuts.
And they're identical twins.
They're identical twins, identical twin brothers. They go everywhere together. They do everything together. And it becomes very clear that they are very different people, right? Even though you're, you know, you have a very close sibling. And so then there's a lot of competition that starts to be fostered between them. And in, I think in particularly like from a cultural perspective, their father, you know, there's like really this ethos of being the stoic, masculine kind of never backing down. Like, it's that military ethos in a lot of ways that their dad really learned in the army.
And it's a very, very Asian dad. Yeah.
Very. Yes. Yeah. Yes. They both brothers, you know, talk to me a lot about that. An is like kind of that, you know, in his father's eyes, like he is the pinnacle of that ethos. And Trung's the brains, which is important, right? Because the parents want them to do well, but Trung never feels fully seen or respected in his dad's eyes, and in some ways in his brother's eyes. And that also kind of, if we're thinking about the psychology of kind of how their relationship like kind of gets them into a lot of bad decisions, it's really that kind of mentality that kind of pushes Trung into various situations that, you know, shape his life in some pretty devastating ways.
So the podcast opens up with the twins, and they're both, I think, 18 years old at the time. They're in community college. They seem to be doing relatively well, but you've mentioned a few times they're kind of caught up in some stuff they shouldn't be and maybe making some bad decisions. So can you tell us what was going on in their lives at that time?
Sure. So, you know, the kind of the working title of the podcast was Double Life, not just because they're twins, but also because they really were living these double lives, you know, through their high school experience. And like Trung in particular, like he's getting good grades. They are, you know, double black belts in Taekwondo. They are going to Boy Scouts. There's a Vietnamese American Boy Scout troop, and they are going to Boy Scouts every week. Trung is, you know, getting elected to leadership positions and is on his way to becoming an Eagle Scout. And then a day later, so like that would be like Saturday, and then like Sunday, they are selling drugs, burgling houses, stealing from the mall, and they end up getting involved in this organized crime organization in which rival groups are fighting each other. And so they are kind of the foot soldiers. They become the foot soldiers in one of those groups. And it's, you know, it's really about trying to find, it's like belonging, identity, power. I think especially for Trung, feeling like I can be someone and I can have all these things. My parents promised me the American dream. I don't see that dream anywhere. I'm going to find it and take it for myself. Yeah.
Lowe's has the brands pros trust to get the job done. You can now shop new Catalyst fencing solutions and save big when you do. 10% off when you buy in bulk. Plus, save $180 on a DeWalt 12-inch dual bevel sliding compound miter saw. Now just $449. Our best lineup is here at Lowe's. Valid through 5/6 while supplies last. Selection varies by location.
Weight Watchers now offers access to affordable GLP-1s. It works for members like...
I'm Haley, and I've lost 100 pounds. Weight Watchers has everything I need, from weight loss medications to nutrition support and help with my side effects. It's all in one place.
Weight Watchers handles the insurance for you and offers affordable cash pay options. With our program, our members are losing more weight with expert nutrition and side effect support.
I'm Mike, and I've lost 135 pounds. Weight Watchers prescribing GLP-1 medications, it's been life-changing.
I'm Sharia, and I lost 80 pounds on Weight Watchers.
I realized that it would take more than a prescription to lose weight and feel good on a GLP-1.
Better results, expert support, lose more weight, make it last.
I can't imagine doing a GLP-1 without Weight Watchers.
Get started for as low as $25 at weightwatchers.com/new.
Medications require eligibility and prescription. Patients on 15 milligrams of tirzepatide had an average of 21% weight loss in a 72-week clinical trial when paired with diet and exercise. First month as low as $25 with a 12-month MedPlus plan. Does not include the cost of GLP-1 medications.
And this all kind of comes together in terms of speaking of being Shakespearean, of what they're caught up in, the immigrant experience, not being with their mother for all these years, and this question of, we have one brother charged with this crime, and it's the other brother, and there's this code. You mentioned the code in the podcast, right? So all of this is kind of at play when this twin brother is deciding, do I come forward and confess that I'm the brother who did the stabbing and not my brother who's behind bars?
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to give too much away about why.
I promise our audience will still listen. It's so well made. It's so well done. Such an incredible story.
No, thank you. Yeah. Go ahead.
No, but I was going to say, and can you tell us a little bit about like the crime at the heart of this and you know, the victim and what happened? You know, what kind of crime? Because that also is like makes a big difference in the story.
So, you know, there's just kind of... I say in the show that Shakespeare is a master of turning irony into tragedy. Mm. And that kind of plays out again and again in the show and in the twins' lives. The moment at which this precipitating event happens, the twins, so they, because of their involvement in these criminal activities, they actually have a hit out on them.
Oh.
And they are like incredibly stressed out. They are kind of hiding in a lot of ways. They're in hiding. And they're trying to figure out, like, can we get ourselves out of this criminal underworld that we've gotten ourselves into? Because now people want us dead.
And they're children. I mean, they're 18 years old.
I mean, when this happens, their birthday is in August. It's January. Mm. So, you know, they're 18 and a half. And they hear about a party in a nice neighborhood in San Jose, like 15 minutes, but like five worlds away, right, from where they've grown up. This is not a party where there will be any people from the lifestyle, as they call it. This is like, this will be young professionals, college kids. And so they decide to go to this party because, like, it'll be in a way like they feel they'll be safe there. It'll be a night off from like worrying about all this stuff. And so they go to this party. They don't really know a lot of people there. He's the fighter. He's the one, you know, that his dad is always praising for being the tough one, for standing up for himself. And also An's very impulsive, and especially when he gets intoxicated. So a fight breaks out. An is like really in the middle of this thing. Trung, who is also heavily intoxicated at this point, but is also in this like very specific psychological space where he's been beaten down and beaten down. He feels like nobody respects him, and he feels like he's got to prove something. Like this is kind of the headspace that he's in. And so he sees his brother in this fight, and you know, it's unclear to the extent to which his brother was actually in trouble. I'm not sure that An was really in trouble. Like An had been in fights that were significantly more dangerous than this. But Trung, you know, this is all kind of all what's swirling in his head. And at first he tries to like get his brother out of the fight. He actually, they carry switchblades with them everywhere for protection. Trung has left his switchblade at home because he doesn't want to get into anything. But then when he sees An fighting, he goes up and takes An's switchblade away to basically stop his brother from doing something dumb. But then when he thinks that his brother's in trouble and then all this other stuff going on in his head, he just kind of snaps. He pulls out his brother's switchblade, jumps into the fight, and ends up stabbing the young man who is fighting with his brother and kills him. Mm-hmm. And then they flee the scene. And it's just, you know, I mean, it is, that's the moment that everything changes. I mean, Trung has taken someone's life.
But they don't realize in that moment that this person has died, right?
No. Yeah. I mean, Trung was intending to wound this guy. Mm. Not that, I mean, you know, I've known the twins for 6 years now. I've talked to them, you know. At the height of this, I was talking to them multiple times a week, like for, you know, years. And it's still just like very hard for me to wrap my head around being in a situation where you make a decision like that. Like, I just kind of can't. But yeah, but they find out the next day that this young man who's a college student has died, and things move on from there.
And this is a fight that happens in front of a lot of different people. The police have plenty of, I mean, it's not hard for them to get to the twins, right?
Yeah.
So, but when they get there, they can't figure out which one it is.
Right. So, you know, it's dark. Everybody's drunk.
Young.
Yeah. I mean, you know, most people are late teens, early 20s. And so, you know, the police interviewed, you know, 30 people at this party, and everybody kept coming back to the twins, but nobody seemed to really know. Like, it was very hard to tell them apart. They were dressed almost identically. And so they're taken to county jail. They're interrogated. And, you know, there's some very powerful footage that I was able to get. And we play some of that tape in the show of prosecutors putting both twins in a holding cell together to see whether they will confess or what, you know, what they can learn.
Conspire. And I mean, like,
conspire. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah.
But that's really where you see, like, these are kids. And you see the depth of their bond, because it is so emotional. I mean, they are crying. They are holding each other. They are, I mean, it's really like, it's interesting to think about, kind of like, you know, one of the things that their dad would always say is like, men don't cry. Mm. Men don't show emotion. And these brothers were completely breaking down, and they were really trying to support each other. And Trung even says, he's like, I got you. Like, I'm gonna figure this out. And then, of course, he ends up, you know, he lets An take the fall. And that's the whole complicated thing. Yeah. But
even, you know, the police put them in the room together, I'm assuming because they want to see if they're going to, like, you know, conspire together, come up with a plan. They've already come up with kind of a plan, though, before the police even got to them, right? Like, they've come to some kind of agreement about how they're going to handle the situation.
Well, yes. Their agreement is that they will not talk.
Yeah.
At all. Like, but that is, you know, I mean, that's their agreement. Like, neither of them are going to say anything. And the reason that they do that, it's partly because of their bond, their relationship. It's partly because they're just terrified. And it's partly because of this world of gangs and organized crime that they've been involved in. And this idea of snitching, which, you know, in some ways is such a common trope that we kind of don't even take it seriously. But the thing that I realized in talking to them is that, like, if An comes forward, right, to say that Trung was the one that killed this young man, he's snitching on his own brother.
Yeah.
And if he's going to snitch on his own brother, then what else would he be willing to give up? And so he's, in a lot of ways, he's really stuck. Mm. And that was like an interesting component of this that I think complicated that idea of, like, just, you know, you don't snitch.
It's a gang code, right? I mean, basically. Or was it more of a cultural code?
I mean, I think it's both. Okay. I think it's definitely both. An adhered to this code so tightly, so steadfastly, that his own attorney, like, he didn't tell his attorney anything. And at a certain point, like, once his attorney understood that he was innocent, like, when he finally, like, a year and a half into this, finally told his attorney.
What?
So, like, his attorney's like, there's something
you're not telling me.
There's something you're not telling me about this situation. And then finally, An confesses to his attorney, okay, I didn't do it. I'm, you know.
Wow.
And then his attorney's like, oh my God, okay, so now let's get to work. And An refuses to help him. Mm-hmm. And his attorney, Clinton, is basically like, all right, well, I'm going to have to solve this on my own because I have the most unhelpful client who is not willing to hurt his brother, even though his brother is currently hurting him.
An is arrested for this. He's charged with this, right? Is Trung charged with anything at all?
So here's what's really interesting. So they're both arrested. And initially, Trung is charged with murder. And An is charged with the accessory. That's what the newspapers reported that. Mm-hmm. And then a week later, the newspapers report that the charges have been switched.
Right.
And that's actually the last thing that the media ever reports about this. Mm. But there was kind of this idea at the time, I got the sense from like reading the coverage, there was like this collective sigh, like, oh, they had the wrong brother. It's really good that they now have the right one, even though they switched from the right one to the wrong one. So Trung is released on bail with an accessory charge, and An is in county jail on a murder charge. And then when Trung finally turns himself in almost 2 years later, and there's a lot of events that precipitate him finally coming forward, the brothers switch places, like literally switch places, and the charges are swapped.
Again.
Yes. And it's no longer, well, when they're sentenced, it becomes a voluntary manslaughter charge, not a murder charge. Mm. But yeah.
And Jen, I wonder, you just mentioned in 2014 these newspaper articles about we arrested one twin and then we switched it and it's this parent trap type situation. And that's it for the media coverage. And so I wonder, when you made the decision to pivot from I started looking into Shakespeare's therapy and now I want to do a deep dive in this case, which beyond those articles didn't have media coverage, what was the response by the twins in terms of how receptive they were to the idea of having their story, warts and all, being told to the public?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, so I did write the story on Shakespeare's therapy. Mm-hmm. And so I did continue to talk to Trung about that story for some time. And I think he really appreciated that story when it came out. And then it was a little bit of time before I started thinking, okay, I want to come back to this because I have so many questions about it. And it was really this years-long process of trust building. So, you know, when I called Trung to basically float the idea, like, I'm interested in hearing more about you and your brother. I don't know what the product of that will be. Like, I don't know. Will it be a book? Will it be a podcast? Will it be a magazine article? Like, I don't know. Hmm. Maybe it will be nothing. How do you feel about us just chatting? And I think he was at a point in his life having at that point, you know, he's out of prison. In prison, he had become licensed as a substance abuse counselor. This is part of the new reforms. Mm. And then now that he's coming out, he's working as a substance abuse counselor with other people that are coming out of prison. He wants to become a therapist, so he's in school to get a master's in social work. He's really trying to make what he calls living amends and to try to give something back to his community for all of this harm that he has caused, which, you know, I think he very much understands, like, he has caused irreparable harm. And so, like, for him, the question is, like, how do you live with that? How do you move on from that? And I think that was the thing, like, he wanted people to understand where he and An had come from, the challenges they'd faced, the really bad decisions they had made, and then how you turn your life around and what that actually looks like. And so I think, like, if we look at it big picture, he wanted the arc of that story to be told. And he understood, I think, his desire to have that arc told, that's with the understanding that, you know, 2/3 of this story is really dark and is really difficult and is going to put out there a lot of really bad things that you have done. But maybe it's worth it to have the darkness in order to try to get to the light. So I think that was kind of writ large, like what he was thinking. But it was also, I talked to them for years before we even broached the idea of making anything public. I mean, it was really just trying to get to know them, build a relationship with them, a rapport with them, and just learn as much about their story as I could. And I didn't know if it would ever see the light of day.
I wonder also if, I mean, part of this is also not part of the redemption journey for him. Is it's like such a public confession, right? It can't get any more public than this. And then also, I mean, it's the lessons to be learned from, you know, of course, people make mistakes. We all make mistakes. But that, you know, there is some kind of, it's even something as serious and significant as this, how people can crawl out of that. I think there's incredible lessons there. I'm wondering, how did the parents deal with all this? Did they know the truth?
So that's really interesting. So the night that the twins were arrested, so their parents knew that they were struggling. I mean, you know, there was impossible to keep kind of all this criminal activity, you know, hidden from their parents. And, you know, there was this one incident where Duk found a gun that An was keeping under the couch because basically, like, people in An's clique were like, we're worried that someone's going to come for you. Here's this gun, like, for protection. And Duk found it and just, you know, loses his mind. I mean, I think An is like 16 at this point. And Duk dismantles the gun and drives around San Jose, like, throwing away individual parts of it, like, around the city. So, like, the parents knew that the twins were up to no good in a lot of ways. The night that they're arrested, the police, they're not living at home, but the police come to the parents' house, kick down the door, and, you know, just this really, and Duk, you know, I spent a while talking to him, like, when the police start banging on his door, I mean, it completely triggers his PTSD from the war. I mean, he's really, it's like throwing him right back into all of that. And Duk now says that he kind of knew that Trung was guilty. And he only revealed that to Trung years later when Trung was about to turn himself in. Trung was driving his dad to the airport and they were having a conversation about it. And Duk said, I always suspected that it was you because I could tell by the look in your eyes and your mugshot. But he, you know, he said it wasn't my place to say anything. Like, this was between you and your brother. And how could I save one twin only to have the other twin then go into jail? Like, he wasn't able to, for whatever reason, he just could not step into the middle of it. And he just kind of let the brothers play it out on their own.
I mean, so I am two episodes into the podcast and, you know, I'm curious to get to the point where I guess Trung is eventually compelled for whatever reason to come forward. But all this time, An says nothing. The brother says nothing. Now, how was the relationship in that time? I'm assuming that he couldn't go visit his brother, I'm guessing, because of like the charges and everything like that. But what are they like now?
So, you know, during that actual time, I mean, they, you know, An was calling Trung like every day. When? I mean, they weren't supposed to be talking. They knew that their calls were all recorded. Right. And that was kind of their code, when. And there was this, there's a scene in the show where on their 19th birthday, Trung and a bunch of friends drive out to county jail and they stand outside across the street with balloons and a cake and like shout. Wow. And An is like looking down, like sees them there. And then they switch places. And then finally, when Trung sentences, he served his sentence and he's out, they move in together.
Wow. Okay.
Which when they told me that, I was like, wait, what? You guys? Like, because the crazy thing is that, you know, I've been talking to them for years by this point, and they have never directly confronted each other about what happened.
Oh God, that's crazy.
It's crazy. And I mean,
but it is such an immigrant thing to do at the same time. Oh my Lord. Wow.
And so actually the so there's six episodes in the series, and the final episode, I finally just asked them. I was like, can we, like, how do you guys feel about sitting down and, like,
Jen's like, I need closure.
I'm like, I need closure. I don't know about you guys. Yeah. So we do, or they do.
Okay.
And it gets real. It gets really real.
Wow.
The new Wegovy pill is now available through Weight Watchers. Powerful GLP-1 results in a simple pill at the lowest price available. And with Weight Watchers, you can get doctor support and personalized nutrition programs. See if you qualify at weightwatchers.com. Ad not reviewed or approved by Novo Nordisk. Weight Watchers now offers access to affordable GLP-1s.
Weight Watchers has everything I need, from weight loss medications to nutrition support and help with my side effects.
With our program, our members are losing more weight with expert nutrition and side effect support.
Weight Watchers prescribing GLP-1 medications, it's been life-changing.
Better results, expert support, lose more weight, make it last. Get started for as low as $25 at weightwatchers.com.
All medications require eligibility and prescription. First month as low as $25 with a 12-month MedPlus plan. Does not include the cost of GLP-1 medications.
I want to sort of take you back to the whole origin of this project in 2020,
yeah,
which is the same year that Maggie O'Farrell's historical fiction novel, Hamnet, comes out. And sort of the thesis of the novel is that the death of Shakespeare's son, Hamnet, prompts the play Hamlet, and this is therapy for Shakespeare. And the whole start of this project is, you meet this individual who's incarcerated, and he is doing drama therapy with Shakespeare, and you've now followed him for upwards of 6 years. And so you also have a background, not only in journalism, but your MFA in fiction. So I wonder, with this firsthand exposure to this program and this individual for 6 years, what is your take on, you know, drama therapy and music therapy and art therapy for incarcerated individuals? And do you see it as something that is especially efficacious?
It is so interesting. So first of all, the program that Trung did, it's called Shakespeare for Social Justice. It's run by the Marin Shakespeare Company. And they, I believe, now have programs in every state prison in California. So it is, like, baked into the California corrections, like, whole ecosystem. There's also a second program for people who get out to then join, to, like, continue that therapy by writing their own plays. And I followed Trung and some other people, like, through that as well. And what's so remarkable to me, I mean, so, like, when you're in prison, there, first of all, there's, like, a lot that you're not, a lot of these men, like, don't feel comfortable talking about, don't feel comfortable, both because of censorship, like, within the prison, but also just because people don't want to reveal themselves. People don't want to be vulnerable. And, you know, if you have done theater, if you've seen theater, like, it is, it's all vulnerability. I mean, that's what it is. You have to embody emotion, like, really deep, complex emotions. And watching those rehearsals and seeing, like, what they require of these men who, you know, you could get hurt in prison for crying, for looking deeply into the eyes of another person,
right?
For really tapping into your pain and then talking about that pain. But doing it through Shakespeare, it's, like, in a way kind of gives you cover. It, like, gives you this vehicle through which to feel into all of that and to be able to process it and try on different characters, different emotions. And so I think in that way, it's been really successful in helping these men to really try to access and feel and communicate all of the trauma that, you know, a lot of them have brought into this prison setting. It gets really complicated, though, because Trung had this experience. So Trung, you know, he loves Shakespeare. I mean, he loves performing. He was in Much Ado About Nothing. He performed, like, a breakdancing act in the middle of the show, like they modernize it. And then he ended up joining this other program, the one that trains you to be a substance abuse counselor. And that one really is like forcing you to face your demons like head on. Like there's no mediating play or force kind of. It's like you and like your trauma and like other and like you are like sharing it directly with other people. Mm. And Trung, I think in some ways, the Shakespeare got really complicated for him because he really, you know, as a natural performer and as someone who kind of felt comfortable performing, he was supposed to be honest in this other program. And the other participants actually started calling him out saying, we can't tell if you're really being honest. Like, you seem like you're performing. Mm. This doesn't feel real to us.
Oh,
like,
wow.
It feels like you are saying that you've done all of the right things, you're working on yourself, you're going through all these steps, but like, do you really believe that? Do you really feel that? Or are you just saying it because you know that it makes you look good? Mm. And they were right. I mean, Trung admitted that. I mean, like they, and it was really hard for him to hear that, but they were right. He spent a lot of time saying that he was better, but actually just performing rehabilitation. And so then it really required a step back and a really hard look at himself to figure out like what's the difference between it being genuine and it being an act.
It seems like Trung is kind of centered in all this, but what about An, who was the person actually incarcerated for what, you know, something he didn't do? What has his journey been like in terms of dealing with the trauma of that?
It's been really hard for him. I mean, another irony here is that when you go to prison in California, you have all of these opportunities to essentially do therapy, to like have people support you, your emotional and psychological landscape, to help you work through your trauma. County jail doesn't provide any of that, right? So he actually had no opportunity to work through that stuff. He didn't have the same support system of all these other incarcerated men, like kind of speaking that truth the way that they did to Trung. An didn't have any of that. And so when he gets out after those 2 years in county jail, he's really adrift. Mm. He doesn't know what he's supposed to do. And he ends up in his kind of like newfound search for meaning. He goes in with some friends and ends up opening an illegal underground club, a strip club, essentially, which gets so popular that a bunch of the people that were trying to kill the twins like a few years back start like they're all rolling in to this club. And then actually there's this really dramatic moment where An realizes like these guys are coming into this club. They still want to kill me. They still want to kill my brother. Like, is there a way to put an end to this? Because I don't want this lifestyle anymore.
Right.
And Trung doesn't want this lifestyle anymore. And so he, in a you know, fairly astounding act of bravery, hashes it out with these guys and kind of puts an end to, like, finally, like, he's the one that kind of extracts them both from the lifestyle in the end. So, like, the victim becomes the hero a little bit.
You know, An always was the one that you said the father praised. And was he the more protective brother? Or was Trung the more protective brother?
It's really hard to say. I feel like they kind of swapped back and forth, swapped those roles. Because physically, An was certainly the more protective brother. I mean, there's this one moment. Trung gets jumped at school and beaten up pretty badly. And An basically retaliates on Trung's behalf and sends this kid to the hospital. So there were many times when An would kind of stand up for Trung in that physical sense. But I would say, like, in a lot of ways, Trung was like was more of the like emotional caretaker, more of the nurturer. Like when An gets jumped into a gang for the first time, like Trung kind of takes him home and like cleans up his wounds and tucks him into bed. So they each kind of have their role as the protector. Mm. But I think that's, at least in Trung's mind, in part, like why he jumped into that fight at the party, because he felt like, you know, his brother had kind of capitalized on that role as like being the one to like physically put himself in harm's way. And like Trung felt like that was a standard that he had to live up to, which, you know, is so problematic. But that's what pushed him in that direction.
I mean, I think our audience is really going to be interested. I know I am, to understand kind of how the police got it so wrong, where the investigations took L's, and like how the system also failed. But, you know, the story is, I think, so much about like these relationships. And your entire series, every episode has a Shakespearean title. Could you tell us about like why you decided to do that?
Yeah. So, I mean, this is back to, you know, what Colin was saying about, you know, like I've been a fiction writer and, you know, I do think of myself as like a storyteller. I'm like a total English nerd. And I, you know, I felt like I didn't want to tell a story that was just kind of straight true crime, because it's not like you find out exactly who commits the crime and like how it happened by the end of the first episode. So like it actually is not even so much in that traditional mold.
Yeah. Like, there's no mystery. Saying, there's no great mystery here. Yeah.
That's right. I mean, the mystery, if to the extent that there's a mystery, it's, you know, why did An not come forward and like what compelled Trung to finally turn himself in? Like, I guess those in a way are the two mysteries that exist. But for me, it was really about their psychology and about their relationship as brothers and these Shakespearean themes of sacrifice, of loyalty, of betrayal, of ambition, identity, belonging, all of these things. And it just felt very fortunate to me that, you know, I had met Trung in this specific Shakespearean setting, and that Shakespeare ended up playing like a really important role in his rehabilitation and in his journey kind of moving through this, that I felt like that gave me license to create this kind of framing device as a way to get at more of the nuance, to get at some of the larger themes. And, you know, even, and so you haven't gotten to this part of the show yet, but Trung himself, the thing that compels him to turn himself in is another tragedy that is in some ways another case of mistaken identity, in which he specifically talks about a friend of his as a Mercutio figure. And if you go back to Romeo and Juliet and you see what happens to Mercutio, a very similar thing happens to Trung's friend. And so these parallels just keep coming up and coming up. And I felt like I had to lean into that.
We love a good literary device on this show, as Colin can. Colin always takes the lead on that. It's an incredible story. I don't believe in coincidences, so I think it was like all meant to kind of unfold the way it did for you to meet him covering this other story that's led you to this other story. But can you tell our listeners where they can find the podcast? And has the whole thing aired, by the way? Or
Yeah, so it's called Blood Will Tell. All episodes are now live. You can get it on Apple, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. It's out from Audible, and it's free. There's no paywall.
And if folks want to follow you and your work, where can they find that?
Sure. So my website is byjennifermiller.com. I am basically not on social media.
Okay. Smart.
So if you want to see my work, you can check out my website. But that's about it.
Thank you so much. I am excited. This is how I'm spending my weekend, is getting through the rest of these episodes. Thank you so much, Jen, for bringing us these stories. Thank you for what you do with your the work with immigrants. That's so meaningful to me. And I wait for the feature film or TV series, because I feel like this is going to end up. All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
All right, bye, guys. Everybody have a great weekend.
All right. You too.
Hey, Undisclosed listeners. It's Meethal, executive producer of Undisclosed Toward Justice. Before I roll through the credits, I've got a few quick notes. By now, most of you probably know about our Facebook community group. If you haven't joined yet, please go to facebook.com/groups/toward justice and answer 3 simple questions and you're in. But seriously, answer the questions, because a bunch of you are still pending since you've only answered 1 or 2. They're easy questions, I promise. In addition to engaging with us through the Facebook group, you can also leave us a voice note at speakpipe.com/undisclosed. We always check the messages, and so far, I think we've answered all of them. We also have a Patreon page with 3 different tiers of perks, the lowest one just being $1, which allows us to continue to do this work. Other tiers include bonus episodes, early access to merch, and even joining Rabia in a live true crime Zoom discussion. just go to patreon.com/undisclosedpod. Now, on to the real credits. A huge shout out to Hannah McCarthy for audio production. Thank you to Patrick Cortez and Ramiro Marquez for our theme music. For anyone new here, you can engage with us online by going to Instagram or Facebook at Undisclosed Podcast. We're also on TikTok, YouTube, and X at Undisclosed Pod. Whether you're a new or returning listener, you can always check out our previous cases and bonus episodes by going to our website at undisclosedpod.com. If you would like to follow Colin and Rabia on social media, you can find Rabia at RabiaSquared2 on Instagram and Colin at EvidenceProf on Instagram, X, and Blue Sky. Thank you all for your continued support and for supporting all of our sponsors. Until next time.